Welcome back to this week's edition of the Midweek Reality Check with Michael Pinto, where I try to keep Wall Street and your money real.
Quick disclosure, this podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing I say constitutes direct investment advice or recommendation to buy or sell any securities. It represents my personal views at the time of the recording, and markets may perform differently than I expect. All investment involves risk, including loss of principal. With that said, let's get into it. This has been a difficult year for anyone who just watches prices rather than balance sheets. Gold set a record above $5,000 an ounce in January and then surrendered nearly a third of that value. Silver, having peaked above 120, was cut almost in half. The mining complex made all-time highs in February and gave back 35%. If price were all the information you would need, you would conclude that the monetary debasement thesis had been discredited. You would conclude that the world had lost interest in hard assets. The financial press obliged, running the predictable headlines about gold's collapse, the death of the inflation trade, the triumphant return of paper. Now examine the ledger. The People's Bank of China has added gold every single month for more than a year and a half, its longest documented accumulation streak on record, lifting official holdings past 75 million troy ounces, some 2,346 tons. And here's the detail that should stop you cold. Beijing's largest monthly purchase in more than 2 years came during the worst month for bullion since 2008. The dollar value of China's hoard fell by roughly $37 billion that month, even as the tonnage increased. They didn't care. They are not trading gold. They are accumulating. And a falling price simply lowers their cost per ounce. Let that sink in. The largest buyer on the planet accelerated its purchases when prices crashed. They didn't panic. That's not a vote of no confidence in gold. That's a vote of no confidence in what gold is priced in. Nor is China alone in ignoring the tape. The European Central Bank reports that gold now constitutes roughly 27% of global central bank reserve assets, up from 20% a year earlier. While the U.S. Treasury share has slipped to about 22%. Here, listen to that again. For the first time since 1996, the world's monetary authorities hold more gold than they hold American government debt. In a survey of 76 central banks this year, 89% expected global gold reserves to rise, and 74% expected their dollar holdings to shrink over the next 5 years. 74% of the world's central bankers are actively planning to reduce their exposure to treasuries. The bond market does not know this yet, but it will. Then there is a development dismissed as a crypto curiosity that ought to be studied in every economics department in the country. Tether, a stable coin issuer, now holds well over 100 tons of independently attested physical gold, ranking among the 30 largest holders on earth, ahead of the central banks of Greece, Qatar, and Australia. Across 6 quarters, it accumulated roughly 73 tons against China's 49. A private company sitting atop a mountain of treasury bills examined its own collateral and concluded it needed something that cannot be conjured into existence by fiat. And this summer, China's largest banks terminated retail leverage paper gold trading tied to the Shanghai Gold Exchange, giving clients three options: close, liquidate, or take delivery. Let me be precise, because the headlines were not. This was not a ban on gold. Physical purchases, accumulation plans, exchange-traded funds, and institutional settlement all continued untouched. What was extinguished was the paper. Hong Kong, meanwhile, launched a trial clearing system for physical bullion. Beijing is migrating its citizens away from synthetic exposure to gold and toward the actual metal that can be touched and felt and weighed. So, price says gold is finished. The ledger says the largest, most price-insensitive, most strategically motivated buyers on the planet are treating decline as an invitation. So which of those two would you rather own? The arithmetic that governs everything. I want to slow down here for a second because this is where most commentary goes wrong. Analysts discuss the Fed, the dollar, the yield curve, and they do so in isolation as if each variable exists in a vacuum. It does not. Every variable in global finance today is a downstream consequence of one foundational fact. The national debt of the United States now stands at $40 trillion, and it is expanding by roughly $2 trillion a year. The average interest rate on marketable treasury debt has risen to roughly 3.4%, and it's going higher, from about 1.5% 5 years ago. And it will keep climbing, as I just said, as low coupon paper matures into today's yields. Annual interest costs have surpassed $1.2 trillion. That's more than the entire U.S. national defense budget. This is not a problem to be solved. It's a constraint to be obeyed. And every monetary and fiscal policy decision made by Washington and the Federal Reserve must now be interpreted through that constraint. The luxury of orthodox policy, genuine tightening, real positive interest rates sustained over time, a shrinking Fed balance sheet, was spent a long time ago. What remains is the management of optics while the arithmetic does what arithmetic always does. Warsh is a serious guy, but the arithmetic is not at all impressed. Chairman Kevin Warsh has done precisely what a serious man would do. He has shortened the post-meeting statement to a fraction of its former length, abolished forward guidance, declined to submit his own projections, and told Congress plainly that this committee has no tolerance for persistently elevated inflation. He is, by temperament and training, the most credible occupant of that chair in a generation. But he is also trapped. The evidence arrived within weeks of his confirmation. At his very first meeting as chairman, the Fed announced it would buy $10 billion per month of treasuries to keep bank reserves ample. Call it plumbing if that comforts you. I call it what it is. The balance sheet is expanding again. Under a hawk, in an economy that the Fed insists is solid. Broad money crossed $23 trillion for the first time in history this year. The rhetoric is hawkish, for sure. The balance sheet is not. This is the manipulation hiding in plain sight. The Fed tells you one thing through its language. The ledger tells you something entirely different. Which one moves markets? The language in the short run. The ledger always in the end. And when inflation readings do moderate, as they have at intervals this year, largely because of housing correcting and feeding through the shelter component, understand precisely what you are being shown. Disinflation is not deliverance, and it certainly isn't deflation. Had the Fed held its 2% target since 2017, the cumulative price level would be up roughly 17%. But it has averaged closer to 3.5%, leaving the index up some 33% over that same span. $1 today purchases what 70 cents purchased a decade ago. Prices rising more slowly from an already unaffordable level is not relief for the middle class. It is a gentler form of mugging, and the financial media presents it as victory. But the bond market is where this all ends. The sovereign debt crisis is not a forecast. It is underway, and it began abroad, which is how these things always begin, before the chickens eventually find their way home. Japan's 40-year bond has broken above 4% for the first time since the tenor was introduced in 2007, against a debt load exceeding 250% of GDP. In Britain, 5% of the 30-year gilt has gone from a ceiling that held for two decades to something closer to a floor. While the Bank of England has run its holdings from a pandemic peak near 900 billion pounds towards 500 billion pounds. Supply is rising everywhere. The buyer of last resort is retreating everywhere. This is Triffin's dilemma arriving precisely on schedule. The issuer of the reserve currency must run perpetual deficits to supply the world with liquidity, and those very deficits eventually destroy confidence in what is being supplied. The dollar share of global reserves has fallen to roughly 58% from about 71% at the turn of the century. Nothing has replaced it. Something is quietly displacing it. Not replacing it, displacing it. One ton at a time. Layered atop this is the energy shock that markets keep trying to declare over. The Strait of Hormuz carries close to a fifth of the world's seaborne oil and has been closed to for at least most of this year. When Saudi Arabia rerouted its exports over land to the Red Sea to bypass the strait, that corridor came under attack as well. Brent has traveled from the 60s to above 110 within a single year, went back down to the high 60s, and now it's back around 90. A world with two contested choke points does not have a temporary problem. It has a new baseline. So supply shock inflation cannot be cured by interest rates. It can be endured or monetized. The Fed knows this. It simply cannot say it. The S&P 500 has spent this year near record highs with a cyclically adjusted price-to-earnings ratio around 42, a level reached only at the peak of the dot-com mania, and market capitalization near 235% of GDP. If price were information, you would conclude that American corporate earnings power had never been stronger. You would conclude the economy was in exceptional health. Now examine the ledger. Only about 4% of S&P 500 constituents sit at their own all-time highs, almost precisely the 2000 reading. Roughly 85% of stocks are underperforming the index itself. The index is not the market. The index is seven companies wearing a market as a costume. And the costume is convincing enough that most investors never look underneath it. But even that costume is starting to fray. And beneath it, credit is fraying while spreads sit near historic tights. Consumer delinquencies are the worst since 2008. Automobile repossessions run at levels last seen in 2009. Payment in kind arrangements now appear in roughly 12% of private credit loans. Borrowers paying lenders in promises rather than cash. That is what a dying credit cycle looks like before the mainstream financial media recognizes it. The gold miners are returning record cash, free cash flow. All-in sustaining costs sit near $1,600 an ounce. Margins exceed $2,500. Free cash flow yields are at record highs. Forward multiples sit at five-year lows. After a deep drawdown in share price with no deterioration whatsoever in the underlying businesses. That is not a broken thesis. That is a market handing you a discount because it mistook a price chart for a fact. The day is approaching, and I believe it approaches faster than consensus imagines, when this Federal Reserve will be compelled to monetize an unprecedented volume of Treasury issuance to prevent long-term interest rates from destroying the federal budget completely, along with the banking system. Inflation will rise as it does, and that means real interest rates will collapse. That is the stagflationary regime in which gold's monetary role is demonstrated rather than just debated about. Not because gold is simply an inflation hedge, which is an imprecise and frequently wrong framing, but because falling real interest rates and falling equity prices eliminate the two principal competitors for capital that gold faces. That day is not yet here, and I look forward to the time when I can really increase my position in the gold miners. Timing is everything here at Pento Portfolio Strategies. But your portfolio does not need to be positioned entirely for it today. However, it must be built with the flexibility to move decisively when the signals arrive. And it must be built by someone who reads the ledger rather than the tape. Price will continue to deceive. The ledger does not know how. And I want to end with just the FOMC meeting. Kevin Warsh chaired his second FOMC meeting and press conference today. Once again, he reaffirmed unconditionally and emphatically that inflation will be brought down to the 2% target. Target hasn't been raised. Target remains at 2, even though it's been above that for 5+ years. They're going back to 2. That's what he said. But he isn't doing anything to achieve that goal whatsoever. The Fed has not raised interest rates, didn't do it in the June meeting, didn't do it in the July meeting, nor has it stopped at all printing money. In fact, since Warsh took the helm of the Fed on May 22nd, he has created $43 billion of high-powered base money supply. There should be periods of unprecedented deflation and inflation in our future. Navigating each cycle by going long or short the appropriate stocks, bonds, currencies, and commodities is the most prudent strategy. Before the U.S. enters its hyperstagflationary phase, which I believe it's destined to suffer through, protracted in nature after the next recession happens, there should be a sinkhole of depression and deflation first. We are prepared to try and protect and profit from it when it arrives. To this point, the inflation, deflation, and economic cycle model signaled a warning to us today to get slightly more defensive. And that is exactly what we did. What are you going to do?
Thank you so much for listening to this edition of The Reality Check, 5 minutes of sanity in an insane world. Please remember, if you're not already an investor with PPS, you can email me directly using mpento@pentoport.com or call the office using 732-772-9500 to get information about our portfolio services. You should also go to Amazon and order my book, The Coming Bond Market Collapse. Subscribers should contact an investment advisor before acting on any information contained in this podcast. No information on this podcast constitutes an offer to sell or buy any financial instruments or to provide any investment services. Subscribers understand there's an inherent risk in investing. PPS is a registered investment advisor.